Chapter 5. Now Naaman was commander of the army of the king of Aram. He was a great man in the sight of his master and highly regarded, because through him the Lord had given victory to Aram. He was a valiant soldier, but he had leprosy. Now bands of raiders from Aram had gone out and taken captive a young girl from Israel, and she served Naaman's wife. She said to her mistress, "If only my master would see the prophet who is in Samaria, he would cure him of his leprosy." Naaman went to his master and told him what the girl from Israel had said. "By all means, go," the king of Aram replied. "I will send a letter to the king of Israel." So Naaman left, taking with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 sets of clothing. The letter that he took to the king of Israel read, "With this letter, I am sending you my servant Naaman, so you may cure him of his leprosy." As soon as the king of Israel read the letter, he tore his robes and said, "Am I God? Can I kill and bring back to life? Why does this fellow send someone to me to be cured of leprosy? See how he's trying to pick a quarrel with me." When Elisha, the man of God, heard that the king of Israel had torn his robes, he sent this message. "Why have you torn your robes? Have the man come to me, and he will know that there is a prophet in Israel." So Naaman went with his horses and his chariots, and he stopped at the door of Elisha's house. Elisha sent a messenger to say to him, "Go wash yourself 7 times in the Jordan, and your flesh will be restored, and you will be clean." But Naaman went away angry and said, "I thought he would surely come out to me and stand and call on the name of the Lord his God, wave his hand over the spot, and cure me of my leprosy. Are not Abana and Parpher, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? Couldn't I wash in them and be cleansed?" So he turned and went off in a rage. Naaman's servants went to him and said, "My father, if the prophet had asked you to do some great thing, would you not have done it? How much more then when he tells you, 'Wash and be cleansed'?" So Naaman went down and dipped himself in the Jordan 7 times, as the man of God had told him, and his flesh was restored and became clean like that of a young boy. Then Naaman and all his attendants went back to the man of God. He stood before him and said, "Now I know there is no God in all the world except Israel. So please accept a gift from your servant." The prophet answered, "As surely as the Lord lives, whom I serve, I will not accept a thing." And even though Naaman urged him, he refused. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
It sounds like we had some really great discussions there. Some, hopefully many things stood out to you in this story. Adrian and I have just been away on holiday. We were in Rotorua. And we decided that we'd go through for a walk in the Redwoods Forest. You know, the beautiful forest with the giant trees, the amazing leaf canopy, the soft forest floor, and that fresh air that you get, that crisp, fresh air that you get only in a forest. So we went to the visitor centre and we had a look at the map and we went, "Oh, we've got a couple of hours, let's do a decent walk." And so we chose our route and we set off. And we started through the Redwood Forest, and it was glorious. There was those trees, that crisp air. And then the track led us out to a road. And we followed the road for a little bit. And then suddenly we were upon the mountain bike trails. This wasn't the lovely forest I was after. And so we headed up a little bit of a hill, finally working out where the arrow was pointing us. And then we headed off on our track, and yeah, we went into a little bit of bush, but it wasn't the Redwoods. And then we climbed up the steep hill. There were some man-made steps, but they were, you know, uneven and a bit too high at times. And then we got to a lookout to look over the city. But it was raining. We didn't see much of the city. So we carried on a little bit more. I'm not one to walk in the rain. I've done my fair share of walking in the rain and the torrential rain and the mud. So I'm not usually a fan, but it was okay. We carried on. I found another lookout. Still nothing to be seen. And then we headed down the hill. We walked past a person who was running up the hill, and all credit to them that they were running up the hill, but I could have walked faster. And then we kept going, and then another crazy person was running up this hill in the rain. And then we got down the bottom of the hill, and we were pretty much at a car park for a mountain bike trail. And then we saw a gravel road with a sign pointing back to the visitor centre. We were like, maybe that's the route to go. And then just off to the right, we saw an arrow, our yellow arrow that we were following. So we went after our yellow arrow, and we saw some more nice trees. I went, oh, maybe this is the bits that the instructions were telling us about. This is quite nice. Oh, look, there's a boardwalk in front of us going through some wetlands. It's underwater. Not a little bit. I probably would have been, you know, close to this deep. We're like, do we go on? Should we take our shoes off? Or we might need to take our pants off too. What are we going to find when we get to the other side? Is it going to be deeper? Is it going to be okay? Oh, hang on, we're in Rotorua. Is the water even okay to walk through? I'd been excited for the boardwalk. I love walking on boardwalks. But we decided, no, probably not the best option. So we turned around, we went back to the road, and we walked along the road. And that was okay. It still wasn't what we'd hoped for. And then the road was underwater. And at this point, I'm going, oh, time's marching on. It's still a bit wet. The hot tub we've booked, you know, I don't have enough time to walk all the way back around the track and still get to my hot tub. What do we do? And then we saw temporary trail this way. So we followed that. It took us back around the water, back to our road, and we made it back to the visitor centre. It didn't have lots of those redwood trees that we were after. It was a walk in the rain, and I don't like the rain. It was steep, was muddy. But yet, when Adrian and I were sitting reflecting on the last night of our holiday, it was one of our highlights. We enjoyed the journey. We enjoyed the trip. We enjoyed the experience, the two of us. It's a little bit like Naaman. The process of his healing didn't quite go the way that he wanted, but he still got healed. He still saw God's goodness. And so today we heard the story of Naaman, the Aramean, the commander of the army, second in charge to the king of Aram. Now these Arameans, they were the enemies of the Israelites. And Naaman was the commander of this army, the commander of the army of the enemies of the Israelites. Yet God, the God of the Israelites, still heals Naaman's leprosy. I want to now kind of talk us through this story again from Naaman's perspective. What was he thinking? Why did he act the way that he did? And so as I just said, Naaman is commander of the Aramean army, basically second in command. He was a great and mighty warrior, important and strong. So we've got this image building Naaman up. And then we hear, but he has leprosy. Now, leprosy is a word used to describe any number of skin conditions during that time. It could be something as simple as eczema, or it could be in the more extreme version. This is a little bit gross, I'm going to explain it anyway. So the worst sort of leprosy affects the nerves. It starts as little red spots and then can develop into white sores all over your body. Your limbs start to become a little disfigured. Your hair might start falling out. Your gums start to recede off your teeth. And as those nerves die in your extremities, your fingers and your toes can start falling off. And then this can continue elsewhere off your body. Maybe your nose rots off. Your entire face gets disfigured. Even if Naaman didn't have that sort of leprosy, there's still the potential that it can develop into worse things. So it's no wonder that he wants to be healed. Now, if Naaman had been an Israelite, he'd have been shunned from his city. He'd have been made to live outside the city gates in torn clothes with messy hair. He'd have been forced to shout, "Unclean! Unclean!" before him wherever he went, to protect the other Israelites from also becoming unclean. These were the laws given to the Israelites in the book of Leviticus. Now, Naaman wasn't an Israelite, so he wasn't subjected to these things. He was an Aramean. He was commander of their army. He was of high standing, so he wouldn't have been subjected to any of that. Yet there was probably still some sort of stigma around him. And so that's the introduction that we're given to Naaman. He's this important person, but he has leprosy. And then we're told that his wife is served by a young girl who was captured from the Israelites by the Aramean army. This young girl was likely a slave who's with no rights or whatever, but she speaks to Naaman and his wife, something she probably wasn't allowed to do. But she boldly shared that there was a man, a prophet in her land, who would be able to heal Naaman. Her land, the land of their enemies, would be able to heal. Here she is speaking out of place of a man of her foreign god, capable of healing. Why does this girl think that her prophet would heal the commander of this opposing enemy army? This seems not to be a thought that struck her mind, or if it has, she's so confident in her God and his healing power that she's willing to risk it, willing to help the enemy. Here she is evangelizing to her new masters. Now, at this point, Naaman probably has every right to kick her out, to punish her, to kill her. But he doesn't. He listens. He hears her. He trusts her. He is willing to go into enemy territory, likely risking his own death, to pursue healing from this prophet, from this foreign god. He seems to be this desperate to be healed. Now, the Samaria that the young girl speaks of, where this prophet is the capital of the northern kingdom of Israel. Judah is the southern kingdom. Its capital is Jerusalem. So just a little history. They used to be one. The 12 tribes of Israel used to be one nation. But King Solomon's son, Rehoboam, decided to tax the northern kingdom too much. And so these people led a revolt led by a guy called Jeroboam. And so Jeroboam becomes the king of Israel, and King Rehoboam stays the king of Judah. The two nations never reconcile, and throughout the remainder of the Old Testament have opposing kings reigning over each individual new kingdom until each kingdom ends up in exile in different directions. So back to Naaman and heading off into the land of Samaria in Israel. His willingness to go there again shows his desperation. But not just his king's also. His king, the king of Aram, is willing to send his 2IC to an enemy king to be healed. They've been warring against this land not long before and will do so not too many chapters later. And the king sends him, not in secret, to go and be healed, but out loud, with full noise, a large, large number of gifts and a letter addressed to the king of Israel. And so off Naaman goes with his power, his wealth, and his might, with the support of his king to the king of Israel. expecting to find the prophet there with the king, expecting that the prophet will be held in high regard like him, be a person of importance like him. But when he gets there, he discovers that's not the case. That his letter to the king, his large entourage, his expensive gifts will not help him. That these things and his influence are not what will get him healed. The king of Israel receives the letter from the king of Aram and meets Naaman, the commander of his enemy army, and thinks that this is all a ruse to start another war. He knows that he has no power to be able to heal people, that he is not able to do as this foreign king has requested of him. And he forgets who else there is around him, who else there is in his kingdom who might be able to help. He forgets that there is this prophet who can heal. He forgets that Elijah has done many miracles, many healings, has even raised a boy from the dead. And so when Elisha sends word to the king that he can heal Naaman, Naaman goes to see him. Now Naaman expects that because he's important and rich, that Elijah will heal him, that Elijah will come out to greet him. But Elijah only sends a messenger. Naaman, the commander, was probably not used to only messengers. He was probably used to being greeted face to face. And he likely would have been insulted that Elijah hadn't come out to meet him. And angry, "Doesn't he know who I am?" probably raged through him, maybe escaped from his lips. And then the messenger speaks. Not a magic incantation that heals Naaman. Not that Elijah would be coming soon to meet Naaman. But just the simple instructions. Go and immerse yourself in the River Jordan 7 times. For those of us reading the story now, there's the added significance of the River Jordan, that place where Jesus was baptized, where Jesus went, immersed himself, and was filled with the Holy Spirit. The same river that Naaman goes into to get cleansed. Now, of course, this was not the way that Naaman had expected things to turn out. Firstly, the prophet wasn't in the king's palace. And then the prophet wouldn't even speak to him. And now he has to go and bathe in some gross Israelite water. Not once, not twice, but 7 times. This was not how it was supposed to be. He's ready to give up on it all. He's ready to go back to Aram. But again, voices speak up. Out of turn, once again, this time his own servants, his own entourage, questioning him on why he's giving up, when all that is asked of him is something easy. No doubt his servants were fearful of his response, but they were also eager to see him well for this mission that they'd set out on in this foreign land to be completed. And so they encourage him. They remind him, "Well, you certainly would have done a challenging thing, wouldn't you, Naaman, if it had been given to you? That would have proved your worth for healing. So why not just do this simple thing?" Now, if it had been a challenging thing, Naaman would have gone and done it, and he would have gone, "Well, it's because I'm so great and awesome that I've been healed." And if Elijah had waved his hands over Naaman, Naaman likely would have thought that it was because of Elijah's power and greatness that had been healed. But that simplicity of going into the river and being cleansed, of being bathing in there, makes it obvious that it was God's power that healed him. And so with his servants, Naaman goes on down to the river. And whenever I think of this, I've always kind of pictured that he'd be the only one down there at the river, that he could just do this in peace. But the reality is it was probably a really busy place. Everyone going about their everyday lives, getting the water for whatever purposes they needed, having the little social chit-chat of the village. Many people would have been down there. And so as Naaman went, was he cautious and timid? Kind of, what am I going to do with all these people around? Or did he just waltz on in with that swagger of the important man going, this is what I've got to do, so I'm just going to do it. Don't let anyone look at me. What would have you been thinking? Would there have been doubt? Would he have got there and gone, oh, should I take off my shoes? What about my clothes? Are they going to get wet? Does that matter? Am I overthinking this? Whatever. So he gets down, he goes down to the river, and he gets in. He submerges himself once, completely under, and stands up. Six more times. Twice he goes under, three times, four. And then he goes, well, why have all these people stopped to watch me? What are they doing? Why are they watching? Five. Oh, this is exhausting. I wonder if Elisha's hiding in those bushes over there. Is he waiting just to make a mockery of me? Me, the commander of this powerful army? Six times. One to go. What happens now? What if I come out of the water and my arms and my legs have still got all this leprosy on them? What if I haven't been healed? What are my servants going to think? Why are all these people going to laugh at me? What if it doesn't work? But why? What if it does work? What if I am healed? I guess I've got nothing to lose. Seventh time, Naaman plunges under the water. And up he comes, checking his arms, his legs. It's gone. I've been healed. He's been healed. His skin is restored, new, like a young boy's skin. He takes a moment, lets it sink in. He shows his servants. And then all of them go back to Elisha, go back to see the prophet, to show him the healing that has been done. And so Naaman shares his delight in being healed. He declares his belief in this foreign god, in the god of his wife's slave girl, in the god of the Israelites. And he offers a gift to Elisha in this delight, some of the great wealth that he has brought with him. He offers in gratitude, but he offers in payment. And Elisha refuses it. Despite Naaman's urging, Elisha refuses it. If Elisha had taken the gift, it would be like him receiving the payment for the healing, as if he had done the work. It would be like him receiving the glory, not God. And so there we have it, the story of Naaman, the commander of the army of Aram, the one with leprosy, healed by the prophet Elisha. And so we see Naaman responding to the call of God, the offer of healing from the little slave girl. We see him do this in his might, in his importance, in his power, believing that in his stature and greatness, God would heal him. That it was because of these and because of his wealth and with the backing of his king that he would be healed. When have we believed this? When have we thought that it is because of who we are and what we do that God would heal us, would love us, would forgive us or work through us? When have we put conditions on God and his acceptance of us, his work in us, and for us. I'm currently doing a book study with a friend on this book, The Good and Beautiful God. It goes through chapter by chapter of different characteristics of God, breaking down some of the false narratives we have of God, and then replacing them with narratives that Jesus reveals of God. This last week, the chapter was looking at God as generous. And it talked of this cultural narrative we have of earning and how earning favour and how that relates to how we see God. That many of us feel that we need to earn God's love, his favour, his forgiveness. And so the author says, the narrative goes like this. Love and forgiveness are commodities that are exchanged for performance. God's love and acceptance and forgiveness must be merited by right living. What God most wants for us is not to sin and instead to do good. When every person in every situation in every day of our lives treats us on the basis of how we look, act, and perform, it is difficult not to project that onto God. After all, God is bigger than our parents, more aware than our authority figures, and sees more of us than our closest friends do. This was a false narrative here that God we're talking of God, that we don't have to earn these things. We've likely all had moments like this where we expect God to do something because we've earned it, because we've done the right thing, because we've acted or said the right thing. Or conversely, we've expected God not to act because we haven't done the right thing or earned it or whatever. But that's not who God is. The author continues, we have never been and never will be in a place where we can turn to God and say, you owe me, I deserve this. We do not deserve anything we have been given. We have earned nothing. We were made without any effort on our part. We breathe undeserved air. The sun gratuitously rises and warms our planet, and along with the unmerited rain, nourishes the land, yielding delicious fruits and grains. It is all manna, the unearned provision of a lavish and loving God. God doesn't love us or accept us, forgive us or heal us because of who we think we are. He does it out of his love for us. And so when Naaman goes to Elisha's house, he goes with all his entourage, willing for them to see the great prophet and the miraculous healing. Sure that Elijah would come and give him that true greeting that he deserved and perform the healing with a wave of a hand. Yet he was met instead by a messenger, sent off with simple instructions, not bestowed the honour, not had the miracle play out how he expected. When have we done this? When have we created a show expectant of what would happen? And then it didn't work out that way. When has God worked in ways that we weren't expecting? Perhaps answered us with a voice or a person with wisdom that we weren't expecting. Naaman is upset by the messenger's instructions to wash 7 times in the water of the Jordan River. Why couldn't he have done it in one of the rivers of his hometown? They're much nicer. They're cleaner. Would have saved the trip. But his servants offer him great advice. They speak timely words of wisdom to him. You'd have happily done something difficult, offered up large sacrifices, done some great act. So why not just do the easy thing? Why not simply wash and be clean? When have we thought this? When have we been disappointed or disheartened by what God has asked of us? Because it's not that big act, that big self-sacrifice, that big commitment, that big laying down of ourselves that we were willing to offer him. When have we tried to forego the simpleness of all that God asks us? Who has spoken into our lives and pointed us in that direction of what God is asking of us? And then we see Naaman's faithfulness, his trust, perhaps his, "Oh, I've got nothing to lose," as he immerses himself into that river 7 times. He listens to what God has asked of him, the way God has promised to heal him. And he does it. And then he is clean. His skin is restored. Naaman is healed. When have we seen God's goodness and God's healing? When has our faith and trust been fulfilled with healing or provision? When I think of God's goodness and provision, the story that comes to mind almost immediately is year after year of God's providing work and housing for me. That's what I think of when I think of God's goodness, his redeeming of his promises, but also thinking of God's healing. Many of us in the room have many, many, many miraculous stories of healing. Just want to share one of my own. A couple of years ago, I was helping out at the intermediate age group program at New Wine Festival. And we just had a session, and part of that session was talking on healing. And so we were encouraged to then go through and check and talk with each member of our small group as the worship session continued to ask if there was anything that they wanted praying for, any healing that they needed. And so I, you know, timidly approached the first couple, and they're like, no, we're fine. And then I approached a third, and she said, "Oh, well, actually, I've got a bit of a knee problem. It's kind of stopped me from participating in some of these fun activities so far at New Wine." I said, "Oh, would you like me to pray for it?" And so I started praying, and then some of the other girls gathered around as well. And so we prayed, and I said, "How's it feeling?" And she said, "Oh, it's a little bit better." And so we continued to pray. And I said, "How's it feeling?" She's like, "Oh, it's much better." And then as the weekend continued, she was able to join in more fully in the program at New Wine to have fun splashing around in the water slide and all the other water games that had been organized. But I just want to add a caveat here around healing. When healing doesn't happen, it's not because of a lack of faith or because of some hidden sin or prayer prayed wrong. We don't know why God doesn't heal sometimes. It's not to punish us or to teach us a lesson. Sometimes it just happens. Likewise, sometimes we ask for healing for one thing and other things get healed as well. The recent Alpha weekend away, our prayer team was praying for one of the guests, and we're praying for her wrist or something. And then someone else from the prayer team said, no, it's a long-lasting foot or ankle issue that she has. So the team started praying for that as well. And both of them were healed. And sometimes we can be praying for physical healing for something, and then some spiritual or some emotional healing can occur as well. Perhaps one of these has been feeding into them, physical. But God knows what it is that our bodies and our minds and our souls need so much more intimately than we do. So when we ask for healing, God heals what it is that needs it most. And so after his healing, Naaman goes back to see Elisha and shows him the healing that he has received. He tries to offer Elijah a present in his gratitude, but Elisha won't take it. Naaman, because of his healing, now believes in God and wishes to worship no other God. He comes to praise Elisha and God for his healing. So I ask, what do we need to offer our thanks and praise to God for? What goodness comes from God that we need to recognize and honor? How do we add a spirit of thankfulness and gratitude to our lives? So we've journeyed with Naaman, the commander of the Aramean army, who just one chapter later in Kings start attacking the Israelites again. The commander of this enemy army. We've journeyed with him in his desperation for healing, in his status, his entitlement, as he's listened to the voices of his servants, as he's humbled himself and done as God commanded, as he's been healed, and then in his gratitude. And so one final question. Which part of Naaman's story has resonated with you most? Which part of Naaman are you today? Let's just take a moment to pray. God, we see in this story so many different aspects of ourselves, so many different ways in that we relate to others. We pray that you nudge us where we need to be nudged. And if it's in our desperation for you or for healing, we pray, we ask God that you come and you meet us afresh. And if it's in our entitlement or our thinking that you must meet us because we're so important, we say sorry. And with hearts of gratitude, we recognize all that it is that you have done for us. Those things we can think of easily. Or perhaps we're sitting here unable to think of things. Let's just think of the sun, the rain, that air that is undeserved. So God, we ask that you come and you meet us wherever it is. That you come and you breathe upon us once again. Amen.